All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Food Lovers Elective, a Craft Conversation Series. At Craft, we seek to foster a transformative regional food system in Western Pennsylvania that recognizes the central role of food systems in our society and values of the people who live and work within them. We envision a food system that is equitable, fostering fairness and transparency across the value chain. A system that is sustainable, actualizing economic, social, and cultural well-being as part of the food system. And a food system that is inclusive, valuing dignity, sovereignty, and the inherent power of all people. Today's episode is Pierogies Tupacora, the transformation of Erie's immigrant food culture. Our student moderator is Peter Zimmer, and an incoming graduate student with Chatham's Food Studies program. He's going to be talking with Delana Graysinger, the director of the U.S. Committee for Immigrants and Refugees in Erie, Pennsylvania. This episode will take about an hour, with the last 10 to 15 minutes reserved for Q&A. Please feel free to engage with each other and our moderator and host throughout using the chat, which is on the bottom of your screen. It's the little talk bubble. If you have any questions, please enter them in the Q&A section, which is also on the bottom of your screen, and it should say Q&A. To send any questions that you may have. And we hope that you guys enjoy this episode. And I will now hand it off to Peter.
Hi, Ani. Thanks for the introduction. Welcome everybody for joining us today. My name is Peter. As Ani mentioned, I'm an incoming student through the Falk School of Sustainability in the Food Studies program. I use he, him pronouns. Today we're going to be discussing the role of immigration in Northwest Pennsylvania and how it's changed over time and the impact it has on our food ecosystem. Our guest today has been working in Erie for nearly a decade with immigrant, refugee, and resettled populations. You can find more of her interviews on NPR's Marketplace and some articles published in The Atlantic. Today, we welcome Delana Graysinger. Hey.
Hey, Peter. Thank you so much for having me here today. This is exciting.
Great. You're welcome. Thanks for coming in. If just to kind of start us off, if you could state your name, preferred pronouns, and then title of your position.
Yeah. So Delana Graysinger, I am the director of the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants Field Office in Erie, Pennsylvania. I'm actually serving as interim for the Cleveland office, which I do from time to time as our network needs to fill gaps, and she and her.
Cool. And how do you kind of verbalize the mission of your organization to stakeholders or donors or, you know, just kind of residents at large?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, we have our formal mission in what we do, but, you know, it's really about protecting those rights and addressing the needs of, you know, the vulnerable populations that we work with. Primarily, refugee resettlement is what we're known for, but we also have programs that allow us to work with immigrants within the community as well. And I'm happy to, you know, at some point, wherever you think appropriate, go over those terms so everybody's on the same page on who we're talking about.
Okay, let's probably take that time right now.
Do it now. All right. Sure. So when we think about immigration, we have an immigration system. And within that system, we like to put labels on individuals. So refugees are individuals who have been forcibly removed from their home country, have fled to a second country, and eventually a third, in their final destination. So it's through the Refugee Act of 1980 that we have a formalized refugee resettlement program. Historically, the Institute has been in the community since 1919, and we can think of refugees as individuals who had formerly, you know, were fleeing from the Holocaust and whatnot, who came over. We just didn't have that formal program. Immigrants, we tend to, you know, here in Erie, think of more those on student visas or possibly work visas coming into the community. And those are usually the two larger populations we see as far as immigration goes.
Okay. What was kind of your path to landing in Erie?
I started in 98-ish at the International Institute of Akron. So the international institutes are historically, they were YWCAs and offered English and citizenship classes. So there's one actually in Los Angeles as well, Buffalo. So you'll see them around still with that name. Started there. I've gone to school, just kind of moved my way around. You know, I wanted to run an office. I wanted to make those decisions that I felt, you know, could really impact communities and individuals. And the opportunity came up in Erie, and I said, you know, I'll go for it. So I was in Pittsburgh prior to this, and had gone back to Akron, home base, and then left to come to Erie. So.
Okay. Yeah, so today we're primarily talking about Erie. So I just kind of wanted to offer a little bit of context for, you know, folks in the audience who may not be as familiar. You know, the name Erie comes from the Iroquois people, the Erie Nation, who inhabited the southern shores of Lake Erie, ultimately kind of annihilated or absorbed through the conflicts with the Iroquois Confederacy. The Erie Nation may have kind of been destroyed in part, tragically and interestingly enough, due to their acceptance of Huron refugees through similar conflict. You know, the area was later established a fort through the French and then the British, and then under a number of different land claim disputes through states and First Nations, came under control to Pennsylvania in 1792. As far as kind of contemporary and modern populations, currently it's the fourth largest city. Largest population was 140,000 in about 1960. We've seen a kind of precipitous decline and anticipated to see our current census of 2020 to drop below 100,000. So kind of with that context, in our contemporary frame, looking at kind of the current map of the food ecosystem, restaurants, markets in the city, typically we find places on the western side, the older neighborhoods, predominantly kind of Italian names, Caleo's, Serafina's, Miscusi. The eastern neighborhoods, a little bit younger, a lot of kind of Eastern European descent or Baniacs, Nostrovia, Drabowski's. And now currently, kind of perhaps in the last couple of decades, hopefully you can kind of lend a little bit more context, but we're seeing names like, you know, Kamana Market, Peace African Market, Annapurna Kitchen, Gorka Market. And these are really kind of centered towards the middle of the city, kind of between Parade and French, if people are familiar with that. So I'm curious, you know, in your time in Erie and perhaps Western Pennsylvania at large, how has that shift in populations, you know, presented to you? You know, what have you witnessed? How have things kind of shifted here?
Yeah, so when we think of resettlement, and resettlement is primarily, you know, it's the largest group of, when we look at that immigration system, again, largest group of individuals coming into the city of Erie. Resettlement goes in waves, right? So in the 90s, we looked at the Bosnians, right? We have a large population of Bosnians that came in. You know, when we look at food, I know there were several pizza shops that Bosnians owned that perhaps didn't present as Bosnians, but I will tell you the dough tasted a lot different than some of the other pizza shops. So, you know, things like that are small twists to pizza that, you know, you would think, oh, well, that's good. You know, a lot of chicken on pizza kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the 90s, we had Bosnians, and then we saw the Bhutanese. That resettlement has since stopped. And then we moved into what we're seeing as Syrians, more Congolese. The Congolese have been, unfortunately, in situations for decades, so they tend to go in waves in and out. But Syrians are the newer group, although that conflict is not new at this point, but the newer group coming into town, Iraqis. We're in the 2000s as well. So, you know, as those waves come, and you usually look at about a decade of resettlement to start to stop of a population, what you'll see is then the stores and the restaurants and the food markets start to change, right? Because those individuals are looking to cater to a growing population. A lot of entrepreneurs, you know, we see within these communities and an opportunity for them to start a business which is familiar to them and again cater to their own population. So you'll see that wave, and then the restaurants that are of course, you know, good, solid, you know, sound business models, you know, stick around. So
yeah, so does that I guess I'm kind of hearing that it sounds like during these new waves, you've got kind of startups that are maybe intermittent or shorter term. Are a number of those kind of phased out? Are people moving into other industries, or, you know, are we still seeing like the Bosnian, you know, pizza shops around?
We are not. The last one closed probably about 6 years ago that I know of. I think what happens is, you know, restaurants are hard to run. They're hard to keep open, you know, and people do it, you know, and then for one reason or the other, you know, it's something you might get out of, you know. And I know when we look at in Erie, you know, space is limited and where you can open a restaurant, you know, there are zoning restrictions and health code and all that kind of stuff that may limit where people can open spaces. So.
As far as kind of your organization and offering some of the programming, I know there's some, you know, small business development, I think even some agricultural training. Can you just share a little bit about those and what those kind of look like for your clients?
Yeah, so about 6 years ago, there was an opportunity through the Office of Refugee Resettlement for us to apply. It's a grant program for us that allows us to offer small business loans to refugee populations. So refugee is anybody who's under within the United States under 5 years. So anybody who's been here under 5 years would be eligible for the program. They go through a training course, do a business plan, give us financials, you know, basically make their pitch to us on why we should, you know, give them this loan, because to them it is a loan. They do pay it back. We keep interest as low as we can. You know, it's meant to be a friendly, you know, access to resources versus a penalizing program. And I think with that, you've started to see a few more places pop up that you maybe would not have seen otherwise. And then from that, we realized that we had some farmers, and again, another opportunity to go after funding. And that's really looking at urban agriculture and changing, you know, looking at food deserts, filling a gap there that we've seen some other folks doing in town, but then again, giving the opportunity to our refugee population, again, to build those skills that they're coming with and transfer them here and build a life, so.
Are there some specific examples of recent successes? I'm kind of curious about the urban agriculture and that component, how that's been progressing.
Yeah, that program actually has been great. So we're in this is our second year of it. And so we've been able to, it's nice. So we've been able to, what we've done is we went to the city, we're able to secure empty lots, rehab them in order to plant on or do raised beds if the soil was poor. French Street Farms, which is owned by a woman in town, is right at the end of it. French and we're German and she's down on French. So you can run like, and then Sisters of St. Joseph are at the front with their kind of community garden. So, you know, if you get on the whole 22nd Street, it's little urban farms. We have three commercial farmers that work those lands, and the commercial farmers basically provide to our CSA. We do a farm to table dinner event right after harvest, second week in October is finished, and then farmers market every Monday. And the proceeds are divvied up between those three individuals. So maybe not making a living, but definitely getting some money back. They're also able, the program gives them all the supplies and resources they need. So money's not coming out of their pocket to grow anything, so they can grow the vegetables they'd like. We have another track to that, which is more of a personal track, where individuals who may just want more plots to grow, we have those individuals coming in, just families. And then with our childcare, we have a childcare center, the community garden space, the childcare center goes over and the kids have plots there where they're growing. So we've been successful with that and able to build into additional grants for additional support long-term, more of that small business component in some of the grants that I can talk about once we get the okay from the funder to release that. And then also, you know, I just think, you know, as far as the community goes, really investing back into the community and cleaning up spaces and making them usable and you know, neighbor friendly, so.
Yeah, that component just sounds like a real, you know, basis covered in, you know, access to resources and materials and the childcare, and then you know, doubling down on the efforts to revitalize and enhance, you know, number of lots just kind of in the area that's perhaps, you know, obviously affected through the declining, you know, population. So is that seen, you know, greater? I know there's a number of kind of like satellites and analogs you were saying about Cleveland. Is this a model that's replicable? Did you find it from elsewhere? Is it being kind of spread across the communities?
So the grant we received from Office of Refugee Resettlements is really across the country. You'll see it in various locations. Cleveland, the office there has the same grant. They do theirs a little bit differently than ours, but similar idea, you know, empty lots going in, you know, utilizing them, getting people, you know, into farmers markets and connected to, you know, a different segment, restaurants, things like that. So it's definitely replicable. It's not necessarily innovative. I think what it does for Erie is it's new to Erie and it's allowing us to improve, you know, land that was out of, you know, out of use. So.
Yeah. So I guess kind of in that same vein, you know, in addition to the zoning for restaurants or markets, there's also like land use. You know, what other barriers do you seem to come up against, whether it's kind of a, I guess, economic or like local policy or zoning that either you're able to work with policy makers or kind of like work your way around in these neighborhoods?
Yeah, so I mean, the city's been great. So, but there are farming regulation, urban farming regulations. So, for example, you have to have a fence around the property that you're using. That's great, but we didn't have that in the grant originally. So we had to go find additional funding, right, to even get that up and running, a challenge that anybody would have, you know, and maybe, you know, on us not doing our homework, but you know, lesson learned, it worked out. And again, the city was great to work with. They were supportive and not, you know, penalizing. The thing that we see with our clients, and I know this has been kind of a buzz in the city of Erie itself, but our client, they really want chickens. And so chickens are not allowed in the city of Erie. So that's one that I know, there's a group called Chicks for Erie, really looking at pushing and changing that. But yes, our clients would love to have chickens. So, and actually it's something that we actually educate against, because we will end up with clients who go and get chickens and we're like, you can't have chickens. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's, I guess I'm curious, is there, you know, is there access to these types of programs or branching out to outside of the city within like Erie County at large? Are some of maybe your clients who have gone through this program looking to enterprise into a larger or more kind of rural market garden or farmer's garden?
Yeah, we have two farmers who have gone larger scale. And what they've done is it's a Syrian kind of cohort of individuals. So it originally started kind of as a joke, because we had the butcher and the baker, but no candlestick maker, right? But they went in and bought farmland through our small business program, lease to own. And, you know, what they're looking to do is really grow produce so that can be sold back to Syrian markets and Syrian restaurants within a larger kind of north. So Detroit is, Dearborn is a big hub for Arabic-speaking individuals, Syrians in particular, but, you know, so short of going to Dearborn, what can they bring back this way that can serve like Pittsburgh, Buffalo, you know, that kind of northeast area. So that's kind of what they're pursuing. So they're in their second year with that.
Cool. I did want to mention, I'm not sure if Ani had prompted this, but folks in the audience for Q&A, if you've got, you know, follow-up questions, we'll kind of get to those later. You know, more the, you know, the struggles of the last year are pretty apparent for most individuals. And I'm just curious, were there, you know, how your population, how your clients were able to respond, what types of potential resources, whether it was for these new enterprises or just as, you know, immigrant populations in general were available either locally through the state or, you know, for federal resources and, you know, kind of give a bit of a roadmap of maybe how some forms of resiliency popped up and what that looked like over the last, I mean, 18 months at this point.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that's been interesting within some of our populations. So, you know, we were, of course, a resource. We have a program coordinator who was able to connect individuals with resources, you know, the grants, the funding coming out to make sure that businesses were supported. We had a few businesses that initially took loans and then we just delayed their opening so that, you know, they weren't opening in the middle of a pandemic. We have a barber, for example, in his shop. Actually, once some of the restrictions were lifted somewhat, he went ahead and opened. So there were a few things that happened along those lines. You know, I would say every refugee population kind of viewed the pandemic differently. There were populations who, you know, followed the guidelines and stayed within those guidelines. And then there were populations who were much more liberal with them, you know, representative of, you know, America in general. And, you know, I think that those views directly impacted how they would then operate their businesses and how that looked. So, yeah, there were definitely some that resiliency maybe wasn't such a concern because maybe they were not following the guidelines as some others would, or, you know, we would like to see them. And then there were others who, you know, did, you know, follow them very strictly. And those tend to be the ones that came for more assistance. So.
Okay. As far as kind of the customer base for some of these, you know, whether it's like the markets or the restaurants, I suppose, are you finding that predominantly it's folks within those own communities, population at large in the Erie area coming out and supporting these places? Is it maybe, you know, is visibility or awareness kind of a concern for tapping into that, to the larger, you know, resident populations?
Yeah, I think by and large, they're serving their own communities. I know that, you know, we've tried and there have been other community partners and individuals that have definitely, you know, where and when we can highlight, you know, the small businesses. Erie Arts and Culture has been a great partner in really highlighting, you know, those small businesses, refugee-owned small businesses. I would say that some of that is changing. You know, I definitely see more of the larger population going into some of these stores and, you know, for example, the Bhutanese store on Parade, they definitely have more foot traffic. Shaw Market, which is a Middle Eastern Syrian owned store, they definitely have, you know, some more folks going in there that are not from the community. So Habibi, which is a Middle Eastern restaurant as well, Syrian owned, you know, I think that's by and large, most diners are, you know, the more general Erie community versus a Syrian population. So I think the longer stores and restaurants are within in the community, the more you see that transition.
Sure. Yeah, I've been kind of watching, I guess it's been over the summer that Erie Arts and Culture has really done like a nice expose on specifically markets, food systems, mm-hmm. restaurants that are, you know, regularly everybody's eating. Everybody can try these spots. And they actually have a really excellent document kind of on their website that maybe people can check out if you're in the Erie area and you want to find out some of these places. Are there any particular restaurants that you find yourself frequently, you know, tasting at?
Well, I'm a little spoiled because I just get food. We have food all the time in the office when we can, so we don't have to go very far. So I would say the Shawarma Station. So the EDDC is doing their food hall. I think that's another change in Erie and the way we look at food. And Shawarma Station will be part of that. And I would say if you haven't had shawarma, you definitely should check that out. And that's probably been one of my newer favorites.
Okay. Yeah, I was up last weekend and I stopped at the Annapurna Kitchen, which I guess was the first one for me. That seems like that gets a fair amount of traction.
And if you go to the UK supermarkets, so we call it hot rice, but it's street food. It's like a puffed rice. It's excellent. You should check that out. You just kind of eat it with a spoon.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Bhutanese food. Again, street food, you just get a bowl of it, you know, but that's another favorite. So,
yeah, that kind of brings up a question. So Erie, their summer outdoor, Great Tuesdays, and their multiple different weekends, is there an opportunity, or is this something that's maybe existed where some of these folks have been able to, sell their food, get permits to, be part of the food truck scene or kind of, food carts?
Yeah, so Shawarma Station definitely has a food truck, and they were part of it up until COVID. There's a gentleman, and I'm going to forget he has a food truck, and now he actually from that opened a physical store, and it will come to me. Excellent Indian food, definitely above average. He and his wife, I met with them a couple times. They were potentially going to take a loan from us to do some rehab to their food truck, and then COVID hit. So, but they did end up opening a physical store. So the name will come to me. If not, I'll put it in the chat. Should definitely check them out. So,
I think we kind of, I was curious more about, just the relationship with Erie in general. You said, working with the city itself has been, pretty successful and very responsive. Is access to the actual locations, like the real estate, is that an ongoing concern, or is that also kind of like a receptive population?
I think in general, there's a real motivation, I think, over the past. I've definitely seen a change from when I came to town, almost a decade ago. Erie's always been a receptive, welcoming community, but I think there's been a real change in culture and just thinking and realizing that diversity is attractive and people want that here. So, the barriers that are there, I don't think are barriers that exist exclusively to the refugee or immigrant population as far as storefronts and things like that go. It's just an older stock, zoning codes, things like that, that anybody would encounter. I would say capital is one. Access to capital maybe is not caught up, and that's where the barrier might be. So I know lately, probably the past year, probably coming out of COVID, is really, there's been a highlight. And I think people recognize that there is a discrepancy between low-income minority populations having access to capital in the same way that the rest of the community may. So that's something that's been at the table a lot in a conversation, and how that can be looked at and addressed. So,
are you finding that's coming more from like a philanthropic or bureaucratic government angle, or is there also maybe like a private investment component to that capital restraint as well?
So I think it's just really an antiquated banking system that favors white men, sorry. That's the reality of it. You to take a population that's historically unbanked and bring them into a system, and really, it's getting both sides to really come to the table and have that conversation and what that means. We've got great partners in town. First National has been a partner of ours for a long time. Not to give them a plug, but I do appreciate them, and they work with our population and our small business owners. So we've kind of triaged it out where small business owners can start with us. They can move up to Bridgeway Capital is another, they can give larger loans than we can, kind of a middle thing. And then First National is on the other end. Once they've been here longer, more established, can take those larger loans that you really need for like a restaurant renovation or something.
Okay. What is kind of the, the timeline that you typically see with folks arriving, you know, kind of getting established, being able to then access these resources and potentially open up some of these, you know, entrepreneurial food ventures?
Yeah, so in general, you know, I can even take a couple of my staff members and give you their timeline. You know, so upon arrival, you know, they've arrived, tend to go to work right away, work, you know, are working jobs that they know are not long-term going to be truly self-sustaining, or put their kids through college. And so, you know, folks live in extended families, which allows for some savings. Usually about year two or three, there'll be a home purchase. Year five, you get, you know, your citizenship, but about year six or seven, you're really looking at those larger business ventures, if that's the path you're going for. At the mall, Rocky Mountain Chocolate is owned by one of my staff members and his family. Okay. And so, you know, that was a very large loan that they had to take. And, you know, again, about 8 years in, 9 years in, that's where they were at. Prior to that, they own a bunch of rental properties. So, you know, they had been building that timeline. And that seems to be, if you've got that entrepreneurial spirit, you know, that's where you're going. Contractors, again, a couple of folks who have opened restaurants, you see that maybe about year four, they feel comfortable. So Annapurna Dahl is the owner. He came through us, I think about year six. He used to work at 1201 Kitchen, washed dishes, worked his way up, and then went out on his own. So about year six of being here, seven, he started the restaurant.
Cool. I had something. I guess I'd kind of look at one of the questions here. How, you know, how is the balance between cultural needs and strengths of this community, and then, you know, the communication, or almost like that orientation into the operations of, you know, government policy, landowners. You know, what does that you know, what kind of shape does that take, it, you know, within your organization, communicating to your clients?
Yeah, so I think if I understand it correctly, so because we've been in the community for so long, we have several partners. And that's really key when you're looking at advocating for clients and then making sure that they're part of larger systems. So the city of Erie has a New American Council, and that committee allows the group to make recommendations up to others within the government structure. The Chamber of Commerce is another one that has myself and then a couple other immigrants, refugee-owned business owners on a particular committee for that reason, to make sure that there's diversity. Policies are influenced, thought about from a different perspective. So I think, you know, again, there's a change in the city of Erie in really latching onto that diversity and making it something that's part of systems instead of just outside of.
So you've got partners with your agency working with some of these policymaking bodies. Yeah. And I imagine some of those partners are, you know, recent or past clients or current clients. Okay, so they've got like an active role in making that transition, that cultural transition of.
Yeah, I mean, long-term, the agency, you know, the way I view it and the way I run it, you know, long-term, we shouldn't be here. You know, I mean, that shouldn't be our goal for a family that, you know, is not facing, you know, maybe language, you know, some language barriers, but, you know, if we can remove some of the barriers that are not, you know, mental health or physical barriers, you know, the agency should just give the resources, the stepping stones, you know, and folks move on and are successful on their own and then mentor others, you know, along those same paths. So the agency really should step out at some point and should not continue to work with individuals long-term, unless, again, there are those, you know, extraneous circumstances like mental health challenges, you know, domestic violence, things like that, that fall into that more case management role. But.
Okay. Do you have any kind of specific examples or points of success where you've seen these, partners and kind of like subcommittees within your agency helping to make certain changes or policy decisions?
I would say, and it's not necessarily policy, but the city of Erie did it's an application process. There were a series of things that had to be done. And Erie is deemed a welcoming city, I believe is the correct term. So that looked at policies within this city that existed or didn't exist. For example, access to language within systems and what that meant. And so there were changes that were made and influenced because of that process that we underwent, for sure. And like I said, the Chamber of Commerce has really been active and just, again, looking at policy that's maybe more statewide and making sure that it's inclusive and from a perspective that includes, the minority populations, so.
Okay. Yeah, I know just within, Meadville, a couple years ago, one of the things we're looking at as like a policy shift or kind of a practice shift was, what does it look like when new residents come to town? What type of welcoming entourage or components or even just like access to information, kind of that generational knowledge or local knowledge that a newcomer might not be aware of. I think it's reassuring. I think it's encouraging to see that being so, proactively implemented in Erie. And I guess I'm kind of curious if you see some of your, residents in Erie move out into smaller surrounding, like, Albion or Fairview or Harbor Creek or something, or are they kind of staying in the city predominantly?
Mill Creek's a big one.
Okay.
Mill Creek. Harbor Creek, not so much. I think that could change. Mill Creek for sure. Fairview, no. Yeah, I would say Mill Creek, City of Erie. Those tend to be the two largest.
Okay. I think at this point, we can probably kind of move over to the Q&A unless you had anything particularly you wanted to address at this point.
No, happy for questions. I always think that's okay. the best part. So.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. So if anybody has additional questions, there's the raise hand function. You can also type it into the chat and we'll kind of manage through that. Let me just see where we are in the Q&A. Ani, did you have additional questions in your chat box?
No, I only have what's in the, I have some in the chat. And so I'm going to call on Cynthia to ask her question again, because one of her questions is, what do you think is driving this change? Right. And that question was asked earlier on. So just to kind of give more context.
Cool.
Sure. Dailana, you had just mentioned that you were, Peter had asked, like, if these food businesses that you were seeing open up in refugee communities, if they were being patronized by folks who had been living in Erie for a longer time. And you had said that typically they were kind of specific to their communities, but you had seen a shift in that more recently where some of these folks were getting larger, wider, more diverse traffic to their businesses. And you had mentioned it was related to some marketing, but I just was wondering if there were any other drivers to that you were thinking was bringing different folks to these businesses beyond just the specific refugee community.
Yeah, so I think what's changed is really the dialogue. Again, when, and I'm not gonna take full credit as the agency here, but our small business program has allowed us to be at different tables having different conversations, with, which then highlights, you know, different things within the city. So like I said, Erie Arts and Culture, you know, they really latched onto this. And Pete said, you know, they've got, if it's the thing I'm thinking of, we help them put together all the businesses in town that are refugee or immigrant owned, and you can grab that off their website. And so it's really just more people, I feel, having that conversation and wanting that diversity and reaching out and grabbing onto that. You know, some of the things that we try to do is, you know, anytime we have an event, we really want to make sure that we're highlighting those markets or those restaurants or, you know, things like that. And, it, you know, people get introduced to it and then they're like, oh, yeah, we really love this. Right. And then word spreads. And, you know, so slowly, you know, I can give you grape leaves, for example. Got a staff member, her sister-in-law loves to make grape leaves. She used to buy them at Wegmans, found out that Shawn Market has bigger, better ones for much less. So now she goes over, you know, to the east side, and that's where she gets her grape leaves from, right? And so then she tells other people. So just things like that. I think it's just exposure. And like I said, there's been a shift in just culture and approach in Erie. And I think people wanting to have that diversity, recognizing that the city population is shrinking, you know, things can go a way that maybe, you know, most of us do not want it to go. And so, you know, we're looking at ways and how we can change that. And I think with this population, refugees and immigrants, you know, we have that opportunity to do so.
Yeah, on kind of the, I don't know, 10,000 foot view of, I guess, kind of the demographics and the economy of Erie, like, you know, where, I guess, how do you see things kind of moving? I know, I think it was down at Allegheny you had spoken, and it was really specifically kind of like economic impact of immigrant populations kind of around food systems like this. And, you know, with a declining population, with, you know, larger urban areas kind of emptying, what's kind of a longer term, bigger prospect are you kind of thinking about?
Well, fortunately, we've had a change in administration. So under the past administration, resettlement really took a hit as far as numbers and people coming in. So what we're going to see beginning in October, when our fiscal year begins, is we'll start to see an uptick in refugees being resettled again. So there will be that impact again, you know, in places being rented. And right now we can't keep up with employers. There are so many openings. They just, you know, and we don't have individuals to help them, you know, place. So, you know, some of that's definitely going to change for the positive. The unfortunate side of that is when you speak of policy, you know, resettlement is, you know, really based on federal immigration policy and the feeling at the time of an administration. So long-term, the city of Erie and some of the conversations have been, again, you know, yes, we need the population to grow. It is the only growing population. But what happens if it's not here, you know, and really how are we attracting other individuals? And again, I think for me, it goes back to that diversity conversation, you know, and making sure that we have diverse places that are attractive, that people want to come here, you know, live, work, you know, all that stuff. So. Mm-hmm.
Do you have just kind of at hand, like the kind of whole numbers of population that is growing, the immigrant population, how many folks you've kind of seen come through your agency at over time?
I don't have them right off the top of my head. I can pull them easily and gladly share out with the group. You know, so if you say that the city of Erie has done roughly 500 individuals each year for the last 10 years, I mean, there's a number. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't take into account secondary migrants, which are individuals. So once you can make a place attractive, families will come from other states and cities and whatnot to come and join other family members. It's just a matter of making an area attractive enough for them to do so. And that's usually, again, around affordable living and jobs that pay meaningful wages.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's always kind of one, argument for Northwest Pennsylvania is just the cost of living is quite, approachable. And so have you seen, I imagine a significant population or notable population from, whether it's Cleveland area or Michigan. I'm not sure where else folks would be pulling from to this area.
We tend to pull from more expensive states. So Connecticut, sure. Vermont, North Carolina, where housing is very expensive. Cleveland, Akron, Pittsburgh, no. Those places, jobs can pay very well. Housing, to buy a house can still be affordable in many areas. Cleveland's getting a little outpriced, but some of the neighborhoods are still doable. It's where the rents are, you're paying $1,500 a month for a two-bedroom kind of thing that people, are skipping town and coming to Erie.
Yeah.
Ooh, can I jump in and ask a question? This is Ani, sorry. how do you balance the cultural needs? Because, these refugees and immigrants are coming with their own cultural backgrounds and routines and traditions. How do you kind of balance that within an American, like the way that American government just policies and practices, and just even the different value systems that we kind of have from culture to culture, community to community? How can you balance all of that and decisions that you're making for these communities?
Excellent question. I don't have a great answer. So my approach has always been the community that is here or communities that we've resettled before, they're really the experts, and they inform things. We didn't start a small business program because I had a desire to. We started it because we had a Syrian population of entrepreneurs who could not access traditional banking, and that's why we went after it. So it's for me, it's really got to be informed by the individuals. And anytime you start resettlement, you'll have a group that comes, you struggle, they struggle, you're figuring things out and how that's going to work. And, again, balancing all of those needs and integration and respect of what's trying to happen on the resettlement side and then what's trying to happen, in maintaining, cultural values. And then once that group is here for, a year or so, you're able to have conversations that, again, can inform future programming, ways that they want to be engaged. Most refugee groups are organized. They're coming usually from political situations and so fleeing from political situations. And so they're very familiar with politics and are not afraid to engage in politics. And are much more direct than we are as a society. So that part is already there. And most who want to do that and organize their communities take the initiative to make those contacts or reach out for help if they can't. So it's a give and take and lesson learned along the way on both sides.
Thank you.
There was a food specific question. What's one dish you've tried from the communities that you did not think you would enjoy but ended up loving?
So when I worked in Akron, I ran the education program there. So a student at that time, she was from Myanmar but had lived in Thailand and was a Thai cook. And in order to not be beaten, you had to cook like a native Thai person. Sadly, she was an excellent cook. But she used to make this dish for me, and she did not have enough English and really didn't know the words. She knew them in Thai, but not in Burmese, and so it was just complicated. But I ate it, right? Loved it. Ate it for a long time. About 6-7 months in, she finally figured out all the words. And here I was eating tripe. Had a hard time going back to tripe after I knew what it was. But yeah, you know, I don't say no to anything that's put in front of me. That for better or worse. Okay. So I've had lots of things that maybe I wouldn't have done otherwise.
Did you happen to come up with the gentleman's name who has the Indian restaurant?
I did not, no.
Oh, no.
No, no, hold on, I'll get it. You guys talking.
Okay. Well, that was kind of the last really pressing issue I wanted to get at.
I want to know, Peter, what your dish is.
That's a pretty good one. So the pakora, I wouldn't say that I didn't anticipate liking it because it's effectively like a potato fritter, but those from Annapurna are really excellent. There was and this was years ago, there's an Indian restaurant up on Perry Square that a friend took me to. She knew the owners and was pretty adamant about getting their like special weekend dish that was not available typically. Which I mean, I was excited about, but also, you know, a bit. Okay, that's the name of it, Curry Point. You know, hesitant. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what was in it. It did turn out to be quite good. Wasn't able to eat all that much just due to the heat. And I think I'm pretty good with heat, but that like really smoked me out there, and everyone found it to be pretty entertaining, except me.
Perfect. See, that's all. All I wanted. let's see. Trying to see if there are any more questions. Lexi did have a question of how many refugees or immigrants that you help are seeking just to work in food or want to garden or farm. Do you feel like there's more of a lean towards food business versus other areas?
Most don't want to work in food necessarily. Like as far as like we have restaurants that want to hire, they don't want to work in food. They usually want to be the owners, which I know is working in food, but they want to be the owner of the establishment. We've seen anywhere between, I mean, and I'm sure there's more, but we take about 20 farmers in each year into the program. Last year, we actually had 35 just because of COVID. It was a way for folks to get out. This year, we've got just over 20. So, you know, a decent number that, you know, and from that we do about 5 to 7 who want to be more entrepreneurial with the endeavor. So again, these are under low numbers under the previous administration. So once numbers pick back up, we'll see those numbers skyrocket because we'll have larger numbers coming into the city. So.
Perfect. Let's see, did anybody else have any other questions in the chat or want to ask them live? I can unmute you or whatnot. If not, I really want to thank Peter and Elena for taking the time to sit down and talk to us and kind of educate us and tell us some new spots that we need to visit in Erie. So thank you guys very much for your time. So Chatham Community and Friends, if you want to see what it takes to be in Peter's seat as a student moderator for future episodes, if you would like to be a future guest yourself, please click the link posted in the chat to fill out the submission form, which I didn't post, so that's interesting, but I will do that. Yes, I can do that for you, Lexi. You can also email us at craft@chatham.edu for further information. If you have suggestions for future guests or topics, but maybe you don't want to be a moderator or a guest, please feel free to still reach out to us and let us know. So a survey is going or should pop up as soon as this webinar is concluded. Please fill out this form and give us some feedback just so we can know how to do better and to improve this experience for you guys. And also you'll get a link to the survey and a follow-up email so you can fill it out then. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Craft Chatham. And then finally, stay tuned for next week's episode, Nourishment Via Art, Food, and Activism, Creating a Deeper Sense of Community Through Expression, as student moderator Lindsay Herring talks with Kate Eminger, creative director for Space on Ryder Farm, about art's potential and shedding light on the delicate balance between pleasure and peril found in food today, and the ways food gives expression to social and political life. This episode will air at 2 p.m. next Tuesday, and of course it is free, so invite your friends. Peter and Elena, you are more than welcome to come back if you would like to. All right, thank you guys so much. I appreciate it, and I hope you guys have a good rest of your day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ani. Thanks, Elena.
Bye.